Welcome to the Bible's Greatest Mysteries from Skywatch TV. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I am Sharon Gilbert, and it's show number two with Dr. Doug Petrovich.
Yes.
And we are digging into Egypt.
We are.
Welcome back to the library here, and we're going to dive right in. We're talking about his brand new book.
Got our stuff.
Origins of the Hebrews, evidence, physical evidence that the Israelites, yes, contrary to what you may have heard, they were in Egypt, and the evidence is there. The story of Moses, yeah, we teased last week. This is really fascinating because one of the most interesting characters in Egyptian history, the pharaohs being almost exclusively male with a few exceptions, one of the most prominent being Queen Hatshepsut. Is that correct pronunciation?
Mm-hmm.
Why was she erased from history? That's something scholars have speculated on, you know, palace intrigue that maybe her son decided he was tired of having his stepmother as co-regent and just kind of pushed her out and then decided to erase her from history because the Egyptians were all...
That's what we're always told.
Yeah, it's a patriarchy and you can't have evidence that a woman was actually running the show. Is that how much truth is there to that?
Yeah. Great question. The ancient Egyptians themselves didn't record the reason why this campaign was launched to erase her image.
How much work went into taking her out of history?
An amazing amount. I mean, site after site all over Egypt, this was attempted. And so where her cartouche was carved out, it's scratched out or a new name is put there. Or if a depiction is made of her, you know, like a drawing, it's erased. It's cut right out. So this happened throughout Egypt, site after site. And so there had to be a universal attempt to accomplish this, and it had to be from the top. There's no way that this could be just some popular revolt kind of thing. It had to be organized by the pharaoh himself.
This is a culture, though, that reveres the dead.
They do.
Especially dead pharaohs, and the idea of erasing a pharaoh from your memory is essentially erasing them in the afterlife.
Yeah, it's virtually unprecedented for this to happen to almost anyone, let alone a pharaoh.
Well, it happened to Akhenaten as well, didn't it?
Sure, but this was even a much greater campaign, much more widespread campaign to erase every image of Hatshepsut. And yeah, the question is, why was this done? Because when you erase every image or representation of a person in the physical world, what you do is you eliminate, you obliterate that person from the afterlife. You literally remove them.
This is why in 2 Samuel 18:18, Absalom sets up a pillar because he has no son to keep his name in remembrance.
Right.
Well, to back up, to lead up to what may have led to this, who was Hatshepsut and what was her role in Egyptian history? Where does she fall on the timeline relative to the Israelite sojourn?
Sure. And if you follow a literal interpretation of the numbers, the chronological numbers in the Hebrew Bible, and I'm thinking mostly of passages such as 1 Kings 6:1, which says that in the 480th year after the Exodus that Solomon began the building of the first temple, what the Jews called the first temple. And then Exodus 12:40 and 41, which says 430 years to the very day after Jacob brought his family into Egypt, that's when the Exodus happened. So you can easily get to 1446 as the date of the Exodus and 1876 as the time period when Jacob settled. So if you take that literally, and the 15th century BC is the time of the Exodus, and 1446 is the year of the Exodus, and that's supported by not only biblical chronology, but extra-biblical sources, such as the Jubilee lists and Tyrian marble and other attestations to that time period. But if you take that literally, then Moses would have been born in 1526. And if in Egyptian chronology you take the high chronology view, which is different by 25 years from the low chronology view, so there's only a range of 25 years. But if you take the high chronology as correct, and in my book I try to prove why that's the better position to have, then in 1529 BC, 3 years before Moses was born in 1526, you have Amenhotep I on the throne. And so it would have been a daughter of his. Well, there's only one known daughter of his who survived into adulthood, and her name is Hatshepsut. So she becomes the perfect candidate, the ideal candidate, the only known candidate we have for a daughter who survived into her mature years, who could rescue Moses from the Nile.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it fits perfectly.
So when Moses kills the Egyptian overseer, mm-hmm. and then later the Israelites
totally embarrasses
leave,
his family.
And people remember, oh, Hatshepsut is the one who saved his life. Right. She's the one responsible for all of this bad stuff that's happened mm-hmm. to us. Mm-hmm. And so they try to erase her from history for that?
Yeah. Yeah, and she would have been on the throne at the time that Moses would have killed the Egyptian. And according to history, we don't know that she died at the time she stopped being pharaoh. She may be one of the few pharaohs in history who actually stepped off the throne. Well, she would be in disgrace, wouldn't she,
yes.
if she is the adopted mother, the Egyptian adopted mother, of a Hebrew who used to be a prince, who now killed an Egyptian and fled the country.
Would that be why she abdicated?
That very well could be the reason. I can't come up with any better reason, but it's very plausible.
Oh, my goodness. That's fascinating.
That seems to make more sense than yeah. the other theories yeah. that have been floated.
Mm-hmm. We need a new movie.
So the timeline here, we've got Amenhotep I, who dies in 1529 B.C. or thereabouts, leaving behind Thutmose I, Thutmose II.
Well, he came on the throne in 1529, so he would have died in, what, 1516 maybe?
Yes, mm-hmm. okay.
If you're sitting there frantically writing all these things down, don't worry about it.
I'll put these up
it.
On the screen.
They'll be on the
yes.
screen, but also, if you are really interested in this topic, get the book.
Yeah.
Not only is there a hard, it's a hardback book. It's a great, really well laid out, beefy book for your library, but it's also in Kindle. That's what
it
I
is
got.
In Kindle.
I
yeah.
love my Kindle versions.
Yeah, well, yeah, the electronic searches to yeah. be able to search
make the,
through.
Make the words nice and big.
And it's 9 years of research.
It is, and you really, I mean, this is written in a way that I can understand mm-hmm. it, a layperson, mm-hmm. but also your colleagues
yeah.
can read it, and they will understand every reference you put in.
You're right, Sharon. What I tried to do is seek the perfect balance between making it
accessible.
Acceptable to the scholarly world mm-hmm. and making it accessible to the non-specialist.
I
tried my best to be a tightrope walker balancing that line.
You did a really good job.
I noticed in a lot of the citations, the dates of research that you cited are within the last 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
How much of your work was influenced by recent archaeological finds?
There are citations of 2021 books and articles. So I made it as up-to-date as humanly possible. And a large part of the sources consists of the writings of the Austrian-led archaeological expedition to Avaris, which is the most extensively excavated site in the entire ancient Near East, not just Egypt. And wouldn't you know that God would make that very site, that's the best excavated site in the ancient Near East, the very site where Jacob settled his family, and it gives us access to these incredible golden nuggets.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I've read a number of the papers by the gentleman who led that work there for 40 years, Manfred Bietok.
Yes.
How does he interpret this data?
If he believes in an Israelite exodus, he would assign it to the 13th century B.C., mm. which there's no evidence for. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for him to hold that view. But, of course, the thing is, he could never support what's in my book, whether he agrees with it or not. Why? Because that would harm the relationship that his team would have
sure.
on political grounds.
Sure, with, sure, sure.
Because of the place where the site is located.
Right.
Right.
So there's no way he could ever agree.
So the most he could say then is that there is evidence for Semitic people
yes.
in Avaris. Well, let's talk about that. What kind of evidence is there? How long were the Semitic people of any kind mm-hmm. in Egypt?
Well, certainly at the site of Avaris, if we can focus just on this site, they settle there in what's called the 12th dynasty. That's the dynasty mm-hmm. of Joseph's lifetime. The 18th dynasty is the dynasty of Moses' lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But during the 12th dynasty, they settle there in the 19th century B.C., so it's the 1800s. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And the earliest piece of evidence we have is an inscription that dates to year 5 of the reign of Sesostris III, and I refer to him in my book as the famine pharaoh, because oddly enough, the pharaoh who sat on the throne for the 7 years of abundance before the pharaoh before the famine, well, he is Sesostris II, but he dies in the very transitional year between the seven mm-hmm. years of abundance and the 7 years of famine.
So he would be the pharaoh whose dream Joseph interpreted.
Yes, right. Absolutely, and he would have been very young and just on the throne. And so his irrational response reflects a very young, inexperienced king.
Huh.
But the famine pharaoh, Sesostris III, who takes the throne in the first year of the famine, There's an inscription that's found. It's a Middle Egyptian stela that's found at Avaris, dating to year 5 of his reign. Well, where does that fit biblically? If I'm right with my synchronization, it means 4 plus years, not quite 5 years, into the 7-year famine, right? And what does it document? It's beautiful what it documents. It documents the construction of a dike that connected the Pelusiac branch of the Nile River, where Avaris was located, to the temple, right? Now, why would you all of a sudden in year 5 of Sesostris III need to dig a dike to connect the water to the Egyptian temple where the priests are? Well, if the famine is so bad that, you know, every drip of water is precious.
Drought.
Yeah, there's no way that the water is close enough to them, so you have to bring it right to them to get water to the priests.
And also to bring supplies in.
Yes. So this was modeled after and I prove all of this or argue all of this in my book, what Joseph did immediately after he was elevated to second in command in all of Egypt, and I also connect him to a specific vizier, a known vizier named Sasobek. And by the way, the vizier's name is Sasobek. And on that inscription, it says that the person whose hand is responsible for this, his name is Sasobek.
Ah.
He's not named a vizier there on that inscription. But on other inscriptions, he's named a vizier, Sasobek. And we know of no other Sasobek.
Mm-hmm.
So what Joseph did when he first settled at this site of Lahun, that's where he went right after he was elevated to second in command at Lahun, he built a dike that irrigated water from an offshoot of the Nile River that was flowing to the north to the west of the main body of the Nile River called the Bar Yusuf. And so he irrigated...
The Bar Yusuf?
The Bar Yusuf.
Oh, how
Canal
interesting.
Of Yusuf.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Definitely the word Joseph. But to the west of that, there's a valley. And there's a break. There's a ridge here where there's a break in the ridge, and so it allows the water to go into the Fayum, and you can control it. If you build a dike, you can control the flow of water.
Exactly.
Every Egyptologist will tell you exactly when the what's called the exploitation of the Fayum to create Egypt's breadbasket, which it was until the 20th century A.D.
Hmm.
Every Egyptologist will tell you that the Fayum was first exploited under the reign of Sesostris II, the very pharaoh I told you the Bible would suggest that he is the right candidate for the abundance pharaoh.
Oh, my goodness.
Physical evidence for the construction projects undertaken by Joseph as the vizier of Sesostris II?
Second and third,
all documented in the new book, Origins of the Hebrews by Dr. Doug Petrovich, and our conversation continues straight ahead on the Bible's Greatest Mysteries.
Get the groundbreaking new book by Dr. Douglas Petrovich, Origins of the Hebrews, for your gift of $50 plus shipping and handling. Call toll-free 1-844-750-4985 or log on to skywatchtvstore.com.
Now and take advantage of SkyWatch TV's most groundbreaking deal of the year. With the rediscovery of the ancient prophecies from a mysterious group of prophets and scribes hundreds of years before Christ, your understanding of end times prophecy and the final age of man is about to be forever changed. In Josh Peck's new book, The Lost Prophecies of Qumran, the veil is lifted as you discover how much of what you've been taught about Israel in the first century is incomplete. Shockingly, there were Jewish believers who knew exactly what to expect from the coming Messiah, that he would be God in the flesh, would die for our sins, and even the date of his first arrival. In Josh Peck's new book, The Lost Prophecies of Qumran, you will discover lost prophecies only recently discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls about the time we are now living in, how the enigmatic group known as the Essenes formed and what influence they had on the New Testament, what hidden feasts and festivals the Essenes celebrated, and what messages the group left behind for believers living in the present age, how the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation fit within the Essene timetable, and how an ancient Jewish calendar actually predicts the prophetic significance of the year 2025. But that's not all. For the first time ever, you'll also receive Dr. Ken Johnson's massive 3-book collection entitled The Ancient Mysteries of the Essenes, where Dr. Johnson compiles 3 of his most groundbreaking research studies on the Dead Sea Scrolls into one massive collection. In Book 1, the ancient Dead Sea Scrolls calendar and the prophecies it reveals, you will discover the secrets of the mysterious 364-day calendar used by the ancients since the time of creation and how it has been hidden until now for the appointed time. In Book 2, Ancient Testimonies of the Patriarchs, Autobiographies from the Dead Sea Scrolls, you will hear the previously hidden prophetic texts of such patriarchs as Enos, grandson of Adam, Lamech, father of Noah, Amram, father of Moses and Aaron, and even Enoch from the Book of Enoch fame. And in the most shocking revelation yet, Book 3, The Ancient Order of Melchizedek, you will learn astonishing facts about the enigmatic priest Melchizedek, such as why his priesthood was and is different from that of Levi, why the Messiah was ordained after the order of Melchizedek, and how the facts surrounding this mysterious order dramatically affect the theology and practical applications of our Christian walk today. This collection is an absolute necessity for any researcher's library and for those who want to fully step into the minds of the ancients and see the Dead Sea Scrolls like they never have before. Now you can get this incredible collection for your donation of only $35 plus shipping and handling. So don't miss out on SkyWatch TV's most groundbreaking deal of the year, the Lost Prophecies and Ancient Mysteries Collection, available now at SkyWatchTVStore.com. Order now or call 1-844-750-4985.
Welcome back to the Bible's Greatest Mysteries. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, and we are, boy, this conversation is so fascinating.
Fascinating.
I would like to just get, I'm a very visual person, mm-hmm. so as you're talking about Avaris and the Nile and that particular canal, where relative to the Delta is all of this? Mm-hmm.
So Avaris is in the eastern Nile Delta.
Okay.
It's basically, let's say, roughly halfway between where you really start getting a lot of branching off to create the delta itself. A delta mm-hmm. is in the shape of a triangle, and that's the Greek letter delta,
right?
The D.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about halfway between where the breakoff takes place and the actual Mediterranean Sea, where it dumps into.
So it's close enough to a shoreline that they could also ship.
Yes.
Because, as mm-hmm. you say, the breadbasket of Egypt fed Rome.
Later in history, the Romans depended upon
yes.
the bread, the grain that came mm-hmm. from the Fayum to make bread for them, for Italy, for Rome, and for the other parts of the empire.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Fayum is further south, though, right?
Is further south, and it's on the western side of the Nile River and the Bar Yusuf.
Okay. So by controlling the flow of the Nile into that region, they mm-hmm. basically had a source of irrigation, mm-hmm. and they were able to reclaim land that had previously not been...
Right. It's just sitting there. It's desert land, and now it's irrigated, and all of a sudden, you can create grain galore.
Wow.
So this was the 7 years then of plenty mm-hmm. leading up to the drought years,
yeah.
and then in those years of drought. We read in the Bible the record of how then Joseph used the 7 years of famine then to expand the power of the Pharaoh. How is that reflected in the historical and archaeological record?
That's a fun one, Derek. That's a fun one. There's more about this in my book.
You win the questions.
But if you look at the reigns subsequent to Sesostris II, that'd be Sesostris III mm-hmm. and his son, Amenemhat III, who takes the throne with his father as a co-regent the very year that Jacob dies. So if you look at the record of there are several sites in Egypt and to the south in Nubia, because in year 8 of Sesostris III, and the chronology here is beautiful. The synchronization is perfect. Remember I said Sesostris III takes office the year that the famine begins? The famine's 7 years long.
Mm-hmm.
In year 8 of his reign, the very next year, he attacks Nubia to the south.
Because their soldiers are fed. Nubia's still weak.
Nubia's under the strain of 7 years of famine. But the Egyptians are all well fed. And so their army now can go down, once the famine is over, into Nubia, the Egyptian army, and possess it. So they did. They took it, you know, much further, the border of Egypt down much further. And what they did is they built forts at several places all along the Nile River. And these forts, you know, they provided a military presence, mm-hmm. but they also controlled trade.
Sure.
And so what they did with these forts, they built massive granary silos. That's what they did.
Uh-huh.
To be able to feed the people who were to the south.
Mm-hmm.
So think of the economic position that the Egyptians would have been in.
Wow.
They could have commanded anything for the grain. So they would have brought in supplies ad infinitum by exploiting the Nubians and those further in Africa to the south.
Mm-hmm.
So these forts contained the grain in a post-famine decimated ancient world, and they sold it to the people.
What was in Nubia that they wanted?
Gold is one of the things. Exotic goods. Spices were down further in Africa that they could have access to. Exotic animals mm-hmm. for entertainment and other purposes. So lots of exciting things down there.
Oh, my goodness.
How did this change the political situation inside Egypt? Because it seems to me when you've got a central government that was able to exploit a situation like this, you know, the modern political axiom, never let a good crisis go to waste. What happened to the power of the pharaoh because of this this famine?
This one is really exciting, Derek. Egyptologists are at a complete loss for something that happens sociopolitically in the reign of Sesostris III, the famine pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
Something very unusual happens. In the United States, we have 50 states at the moment, right? Each state is controlled by a governor.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a president of the United States, varying back and forth between Democratic and Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And there's a constant jostling, isn't there, for power between mm-hmm. the two. Imagine, Derek and Sharon, if one day, all of a sudden, the institution of governorship just disappeared from the face of the earth. And now all of the power rests with the president. And you don't even hear anything about the governors. They're just gone. They just disappear. And the record doesn't show what happened in this transition. Hmm. This is exactly what happened in ancient Egypt during the reign of Sesostris III. You have the complete elimination of the nomarchy. Their governors were called nomarchs, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's essentially the same thing. Mm-hmm. The nomarchs just disappear left and right.
Hmm.
Well, guess what the Bible says? That when the famine really intensified, that every person in Egypt had to sell himself or herself to the king, right? First their property and then themselves. That would not exclude the rich nomarchs. But the Bible does say the one class of people who were excluded was the priests.
The priests.
That's
right.
It. But all of the rich governors, the nomarchs, they're not excluded. That's why the entire institution disappears from the earth.
Oh, my goodness.
I just have to laugh because you got the scholars who have been looking at the biblical text, which has been available to us for more than 2,500 years, and saying we just don't understand what could possibly have happened.
If
well, read the book of Genesis.
If only someone had written it down. If only we had a, you know,
if only it were historical, Derek.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
This is hilarious. So for the first 12 dynasties, the Egyptian pharaohs were essentially very weak rulers where the power was decentralized and really held by the nomarchs. But then because of this famine and Joseph, a Hebrew, that consolidated the power of the pharaoh. But that then also allowed the pharaohs to then, a pharaoh to arise who didn't know Joseph, to then oppress the Hebrews.
Oh, exactly, yes.
But at the time of Joseph, of course, when this all happened, think about from the perspective of the pharaoh himself, who now his 50 governors, right, are just gone, and he has absolute power in Egypt. So is Joseph not the best friend he ever has on the planet?
Yes, yes.
Which is why, humanly speaking, that he and his successors would take care of the Hebrews because of what Joseph did for them.
Right, right.
Giving them absolute power in Egypt.
And so it makes sense that they would actually have a statue of Jacob because he would be seen as the progenitor of this great
yes.
man, therefore he has to be a prince of some kind.
Yes, Sharon, and remember what happens according to the Bible with Jacob. Is he buried in Egypt?
No.
No. He's taken to Canaan and buried there. So you don't have his tomb. And if you don't have his tomb to show, you know, Johnny mm-hmm. Hebrew, who's just,
yeah.
you know, grown up,
yeah.
you have nothing to show him, you know, our progenitor, the man we come from, our forefather. Wouldn't it make perfect sense
sure.
to create a statue
sure.
that's going to be a permanent reminder of who Jacob is, his tomb is not there.
So in Avaris then, which was the center of the Hebrew civilization or culture in the land of Egypt then, from the time of Joseph down to the time of Moses, what is the evidence? How did they live? I mean, if they were favored, how did they live?
Well, and we know about this from the archaeological work that was done and the recording of it by the Austrian team, and they did a phenomenal job of publishing all of their work. They're like the best publishers of any site in the ancient Near East. And so they document how the Asiatics there, and that's all they call them. They don't call them the Hebrews. They would never connect them to Hebrews, but they call them Asiatics. They document how the Asiatics became more wealthy and affluential over time. And there were two industries that we see this happen with. One was, and I already mentioned, the lucrative turquoise mining industry that they had. But there was one that became even more outstanding. And I don't know if all your viewers will be excited about this, but it's wine. It's the distribution of wine. That's what made them rich. It's estimated by Manfred Bitok, 6 million large storage jars that are called Canaanite jars were imported from Canaan, from wine growers there, imported into Egypt and distributed and resold. So the Israelites would have been the conduit for this enterprise of selling wine to the Africans. And they became filthy rich.
Because Canaan was perfect territory for growing grapes. Not so much in Egypt.
No,
you don't grow grapes
so much,
well in
my
sand.
Goodness.
Right.
That is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually things turned, and we'll get into that in our upcoming programs as we continue discussing evidence contained in the brand new book by Dr. Doug Petrovich, available in hardback, but also in Kindle if you want to go to Amazon, Origins of the Hebrews. Very detailed research, but very exciting because it proves that the Bible is true. One of the major accounts in the history of the Israelites, and again, as Christians, the origin of our faith as well.
It is indeed.
The evidence is there. The stones are crying out, and we thank you for joining us as we continue our investigation into this, one of the greatest mysteries of the Bible.